This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
So I'm going to be talking about trustworthy AI. Whose trust needs to be earned and how? So a couple of disclosures up here. Probably the most important thing to say is that these are my views and not the views of UCSF or UC Berkeley. So some take-home points. Trust is earned from a person or a community. It's a human thing to trust something. And then the thing that is trusted has to be worthy of that trust. So I think those are really important concepts to have in mind, what trust is. It's a human thing that we trust some object, and that object has to be worthy of our trust. The bottom line, I think, is trustworthiness is best achieved by a continuing demonstration of robustness and reliability. I'm actually going to say that transparency and explainability and all that isn't all that important. Maybe a little different from what you might otherwise hear. And that AI vigilance is where we need to be vigilant. So many of you probably have some notion of what AI and ML and large language models are, but I just wanted to do a quick overview just so we're all on the same page and then dive right in. So artificial intelligence, you probably heard lots and lots of definitions. They're all right, they're all wrong. It's the ability of a machine to perform tasks and behave like an intelligent being. Okay, whether it really is intelligent or not is a philosophical question. We're not going to get there, but it behaves like an intelligent being. Okay, and there are many ways that it gets there. So just keep that in mind. Machine learning is a subtype of AI. AI is a lot more than machine learning. AI is planning. AI is supporting human user interaction. It is reasoning. There's a lot more to it, but machine learning is sort of how we reductively think about AI before, large language models came around. And the way that I would suggest you think about machine learning is computer algorithms that find and apply data in huge amounts of, find patterns in huge amounts of data. And you might think, well, wait, I took a statistics class, isn't that what statistics does? Yes, it is. In fact, it turns out, I would say that if you're in a statistics department, you might call it method statistics. And if you were a computer science department, you would call it machine learning. In some ways, it's the same thing. A bunch of data goes in, you crank some, algorithm, and out comes some conclusion. And so whenever you hear about trustworthy machine learning or transparency or explainability of machine learning, just substitute the word statistics. Do we have trustworthy statistics? Do we have explainable statistics? We weren't so concerned about it. We should have been, I think. But really, machine learning statistics, you can think of them sort of in the sort of, algorithmic transformations of data that give us some kind of answer. Okay. Now, November of 2022 brought us large language models and ChatGPT and so forth. And that really is a very different kind of AI compared to the machine learning, predictive analytics that we have. And it is called generative AI because it generates, and some of you may have heard large language models described as hallucinating stochastic parrots. So why is it a parrot? Because it's a parrot that has heard a lot of words, like all the words on the internet, right? That's what it is. It's just, and it parrots it back, like literally parrots it back based on the patterns that it's seen in all our utterings, on the web, right? Stochastic, fancy word for probabilistic. The parrot parrots the next word with a random probability based on patterns that it's seen before. One word after another, based on patterns before, adds up to a sentence. And the sentence may or may not be true. So we call it hallucinating. It's, there are different words for it. But so it ends up as if it knows something, but it's just a hallucinating stochastic parrot, okay? And there are different, just like there are different species of parrots, right? There's also different species of large language models. You're aware of GPT-4, that's OpenAI, Gemini from Google, Llama 2 from Meta. putting this up here, not because I endorse any of them, but you know, that's to track them, that these models come from these very, very large tech companies. Some of them are proprietary, Gemini, GPT-4 is, Llama 2, for example, is open source, okay? But they're all of this type of model, large language models that are generative AI, which is different from sort of other types of neural network, deep learning models that are machine learning, okay? So that's sort of the background, keep that in mind. Trust and trustworthiness, as I said, trust is a firm belief in the reliability, truthability, or strength of someone or something. So it's humans and it's communities who do the trusting. And the trustworthiness, in this case of AI, is the ability to be relied on as honest or truthful, okay? And so if we think about it, we have patients, clinicians, and public who trust and hallucinating stochastic parrot, and other forms of AI. And the parrot and the non-LLM AI have to have the characteristic of trustworthiness that earns trust from patients, clinicians, and public. And of course, each of those groups have different requirements for what they would trust, right? So it's a relationship. I think it doesn't make sense to say, oh, this program is trusted. That makes no sense to me. It has to be trustworthy for a particular audience in the way that makes sense for that audience. Here are the Health and Human Services principles of trustworthy AI. There are many, many of these principles out there. They're all really about the same, but I'm gonna focus on transparency, explainability, and interpretability, and then we're gonna focus on robust and reliable. And all of these principles are in balance with each other, and there are always trade-offs, but let's dive a little bit deeper. So first of all, algorithmic transparency. Is that sufficient? Does transparency lead in and of itself to trustworthiness? I would say no. I think it's very useful, but it is not at all sufficient. What we do need is a transparency. If we go back, and you know, you can't read the actual text in there, but I've replicated here. All relevant individuals should understand how their data is being used. We had a discussion with the students earlier, that point came up. Absolutely we need transparency, but that's transparency around the policy of data and data sharing and data use. It's not transparency about the algorithm itself. So I think we would need to be really careful when we say transparency. What do we need transparency on? Okay, so yes, I think regardless of AI, we need a transparency on data sharing. We're not really there yet, totally agree. It's not an AI specific question. All relevant individuals should understand how AI systems make decisions. I agree with that one, but look carefully, it's AI systems, and I think the AI system is not just the algorithm itself, it's how the algorithm is implemented, situated within a human context. So it's the organ, it's the hospital that makes the decisions for which the algorithm is a tool. It's the clinician who makes a decision for whom the algorithm is a tool. The algorithm itself rarely makes decisions on its own. It's rare actually to have an algorithm totally be a closed loop. And if it does, it might be something like it adjusts your ventilator settings, right? That kind of thing. There you can say, okay, the algorithm is making a decision. And maybe we need transparency around that. But I think when we're talking about transparency and public trust, it's really around the whole system which makes a decision for which the algorithm I think is just a component. It's an important component, but it's not the only component. So I think the transparency of the algorithm itself is needed, as we'll go in later, for robust and reliable AI, but does not by itself lead to trustworthiness. So I think having, I'm thinking this one through, but if we wrote a policy that said algorithms need to be transparent to earn public trust, I kind of say, well, I don't know how much money we should put into that to enforce that and require that, because that I don't think is really the most important thing. How about inspectability? Algorithms, attributes, and correlations should be open to inspection. So to me, it's kind of like, well, do we need to dissect the parrot? Do we need to look at the entrails? And if we looked at the entrails, like what are we trying to interpret from it? These models, the large language models, are like, I think GPT-4 is 1.7 trillion parameters. It's not inspectable. Like you can't open it up and expect to see something that we can interpret. It's just not how it works. And in fact, we don't know how these things work. At the UCSF School of Medicine, we had recently had Stuart Russell, Professor Stuart Russell from Berkeley, literally wrote the textbook in AI. We also had Peter Lee, who's the head of Microsoft Research. And we actually do not know how these large language models work. We just don't. Getting better insights, Peter Lee said, but we still don't. So if we have inspectable algorithms and we can look under the hood and look at the 1.7 trillion parameters and how the weights are and whatever, what does that tell us? Like, does that make us trust the thing more? I'm not sure that it does. And of course, we don't ask for inspectability of statistical models. We've never done that. You know, show me the weights on your logistic regression that tells me that your insurance claim is rejected. We should have been asking that, but we didn't before, and now we think we do. Let's just be really careful about why we need it. I think we do need inspectability, again, so we can do robust and reliable AI, but again, does not by itself lead to trustworthiness, and if we made it inspectable for the public, I'm not sure that really helps. So again, just trying to say, is it where we want to put our policy eggs? Is that where we want to, put our resources or not? Explainability. Now, this one seems really obvious. We should be able to understand what a model is doing and what it suggests, right? But it's actually not a reasonable expectation of generative AI, of the large language models, ChatGPT, because these things are inherently stochastic. They're inherently probabilistic. And it really is just one sentence after another. And if you think about it conceptually, it's one sentence after another. How in the heck can it really be explaining something about the world? So we want it to explain. We want a story, but it can confabulate a story for us. But it may not be right. And as I said, there are different kinds of AI. There are different representational technologies in AI, like belief networks or knowledge graphs, that do explicitly reason and can give you an answer. It's the wrong thing to ask of generative AI. So I think, again, understanding the technology allows you to ask the right kinds of questions to it. Now, the other point I want to make is that just because something is explainable doesn't mean that the explanation is correct, right? You may remember back in your early studies, the Ptolemaic model, the sun revolves around the earth, right? And that was a model that actually, I did a little bit of looking up in it, the model is actually highly predictive and explanatory for the observed motion of the celestial bodies, right? The Ptolemaic model will tell you where Venus is next morning. And it'll tell you it's because there are 36 epicycles of all the celestial bodies that epicycle around each other, okay? Of course, then the Copernican model came around where the Earth revolves around the sun. And it was also very predictive of where Venus is in the morning, but it's a radically different explanation for what the universe is, where the Earth revolves around the sun, okay? So if you're looking for a prediction of the position of Venus, both of these models were predictively accurate. They were both explanatory, but only one of them was the explanation real, and only one of them would you use to send a spacecraft to Mars, right? So algorithmic explainability does not by itself lead to trustworthiness. I worry that people can come up with a story that sounds real, and then you trust it whereas you really shouldn't. And then the analogy there would be the stock market, where somebody tells you why the stock market went up and down, and it sounds incredibly plausible. It's probably not true. And if you do your investment based on stories that sound true, caution, right? So explainability, I think, is a really, really tricky one. And we have to be really careful that we don't rely on it too much for trustworthiness. So that brings us to robust and reliable, which I think is really what's the most important. And maybe the one take home is to understand that software is fundamentally different in the medical setting from a drug, okay? A drug is a fixed molecular entity. The FDA approves it. It stays the same. It just stays the same. We do monitor for side effects and so forth, but our bodies physically are basically the same. Over the years, our biology doesn't change that much, and then the fixed molecular entity doesn't change that much. But software changes. We get updates, right, on our devices. The performance drifts over time. There's concept drift. So long COVID, hopefully we'll have a better understanding of long COVID in the years to come. But what's coded as long COVID today is going to drift over time. And so the algorithms that work on long COVID are going, their performance is going to change. The way that our variables change, the presentation of COVID is now different. So COVID is a very different disease than it was 4 years ago. So algorithms trained 4 years ago are not going to be accurate. Or the way that we practice medicine, my incentives may have changed, the guidelines that I'm supposed to follow are changed. So now, if my practice pattern has changed, the algorithm is now out of whack with how I practice. Or another case might be the algorithm works really well, and I'm actually changing my practice because of the algorithm. And now, because I practice differently, the algorithm has now gone out of whack with how I practice because the algorithm actually changed the way I practice, right? So we need to be very vigilant about the performance of AI over time, and it's something we can't stop. We can't say, you know, we've monitored it for a year, we're done. It's an ongoing vigilance. That's not how we're set up in the health system, and there are a tremendous number of different methods that we need to do to monitor that. So this is how I think about continuing demonstration of robustness and reliability. We are doing this at UCSF, where on the top we have what's being evaluated, which is the algorithm. We start off with monitoring the performance of the algorithm in a retrospective way. So we just run it on data and see what happens. And then we let it into the wild, you know, into the healthcare system. We do a pilot deployment where we prove that it has some clinical value, right? So we're tracking the data and the algorithm. We're looking for the drift, as we talked about before. We're also looking for patient outcomes. And we should also look for patient trust. We should look at how it's impacting the physician or the clinician. We should look at efficiency metrics, return on investment at the health system level. And I've recently added society, fairness, bias, and justice. So it came up in a recent meeting. It's like, well, isn't anything that helps a patient, like, isn't that inherently good? It's like, no. What if there was a system that was really good for the wealthy patient, for concierge physicians only, and that health system, which is a for-profit health system, is very profitable, but in the end, it just doesn't help anybody else in society, right? So we can actually be really good for the patient, the clinician, the health system, and exacerbate biases in society, and is that good or not? And obviously our system, our capitalism is sort of set up to do that, but AI can exacerbate all of that. So we do need to think, I think, about societal impacts of AI and the way it's constructed and the way that it's run. So this picture, you know, reflects a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done in the health system, both locally within, you know, one medical center like UCSF, but also across, you know, health systems collectively across the nation. There are talks at the federal level about a centralized evaluation, like a national AI assurance lab, for example, and lots of different methods that we need to carry out the demonstration of robustness and reliability, which I think is really the fundamental thing that we need, ongoing demonstration of robustness and reliability. We need the transparency, interpretability, and explainability to allow us to do that kind of demonstration. But that, I think, is the fundamental thing that we need to build into our systems on an ongoing basis, that AI vigilance. That's gonna what I think is gonna earn us the trust of our patients, our clinicians, and our public. There's no time to lose to do that. So thanks to a number of leaders at UCSF and many, many others, of course. And I will stop there.
Okay, thank you to Dr. Kravitz and the rest of the team here at UC Center Sacramento for having me. I am delighted to be able to follow Ida here and talk about AI governance at University of California Health. And I'll spend some time talking about what that is, why it's needed, and some efforts at the state and national level, and then also spend some time talking about some ways of operationalizing it. And so let me start here. AI in healthcare is not new, and I think this was a point that Ida made. So even before generative AI, for a number of years, there has been talk about the promise of AI in healthcare to improve patient outcomes, to increase efficiency, and to expand coverage. And there have definitely been a lot of use cases and also models that have proven not to be measured, to provide a measured benefit to patients and clinicians. So here on the slide here, we have a couple of the common use cases for machine learning and natural language processing in the healthcare setting. So first, improving hospital administration. This has long been an area of study for hospitals and implementation in terms of improving patient scheduling, flow through the hospital, and also reducing and making the administrative burden that affects clinicians lighter. Second, clinical decision support. Researchers have done a lot of work into precision medicine, the tailoring and the using of AI to tailor treatments to particular patients, as well as the ability of AI to help diagnose particular diseases in a way that might be able to aid clinicians. There has been a lot of research particular in the areas of pathology and radiology. Population health management is another area of AI focus in terms of helping with automated screening, and then also population risk stratification and patient self-management tools. So those are all areas where there has been some work. And then finally, of course, patient payment and billing management is another area. Okay, but then as the story goes, generative AI came along. And I think what we have seen since is a tremendous interest and acceleration of interest in deploying AI across the healthcare delivery system. And so here we have just one example. This is a study that came out from UCSD last year, and it compared responses to real-world health questions from patients from ChatGPT, and then also from clinicians. And so a set of clinicians reviewed the responses and found that ChatGPT's responses were overall ranked more highly, both in terms of quality and empathy. And so I'll say a couple things here about this study. First, the researchers made sure to keep humans in the loop. So messages, first of all, patients were notified that there was this going on. And secondly, nothing was ever sent to a patient without being reviewed by a clinician first. So for me, the takeaway here is not that that your doctors will be replaced by ChatGPT, but instead that there is, I think, very real potential for ChatGPT and other generative AI models to potentially reduce some of the administrative burden and increase the ability of providers to provide care with less burnout. And that is, I think, one of the more pressing questions, I think, facing healthcare systems today. So there is the promise of AI. So I tend to be an AI optimist, and I think that not everyone is. And like Ida, I will put aside sort of the large philosophical questions of in the future, is AI going to become sort of sentient. But instead, I'll look at what some of the more practical risks are when it comes to AI. So why do we care about doing AI governance? It is because in order to really benefit from the potential of what these tools are, I think it requires a very honest and a clear-eyed assessment of what the risks are and what are the ways of mitigating those risks. And so here on the slide, you'll have some of the more commonly accepted risks. And this tracks exactly with the HHS slide that Ida showed in her presentation. These are, I think, really where a lot of the risks are in terms of convergence of dividing them into categories. This list here actually comes from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, AI risk management framework, which is a resource that I think many of these frameworks have kind of called back to. So not only, some of the ones I'll talk about coming up, but also, as Ida's mentioned, there have been a lot of frameworks that have come out, and they are all kind of converging on the same set of risks. So later on in this talk, I'll talk a little bit about, okay, so how do we kind of dive deeper and really get to difficult questions about how to mitigate some of these risks? So I won't dwell on these here because I know that Ida spoke about several of them, as well as about kind of what are some of the drawbacks of how to define them. Because I think that is one of the important things. At a high level, it's easy to say transparency, but when you dive down, it's really important to think about, like, what do we really mean? Like, what is important to the people who will be impacted by these tools? And that is, I think, where a lot of work will be done. I will say that I added an eighth one here, and that is workforce and labor impacts. And that I added that because I think that will be one of the pressing questions as well as AI tools are increasingly developed and deployed throughout all of society. And so in addition to the common set of risks, I think that is a risk worth thinking about too. It will change workflows. It may require additional training, but it will also present new tools. And so for this audience, this will be kind of, I think, part of our lives, I think, going forward. Okay, so then I think here is one of my big takeaways, and I think this is now something that is generally accepted. Guardrails are essential for actually being able to develop and deploy these tools effectively. And so on a practical level, I think here is what you get when you have strong AI governance. Here's what we want to achieve. So I think it builds trust. Being trustworthy, as Ida demonstrated, means that users will actually be able to deploy these tools and feel comfortable having them deployed with them in the environments in which they exist. It enables organizations to vet and authorize AI tools more quickly and in a transparent, replicable manner. And so here, I think this is very, very hard to do, but this is an end state where we want to be, where we want to be in a place where an organization is able to take tools that are presented to it or tools that are developed there and deploy them and have those around them and those who are impacted understand how it's going to impact them, that it will impact them the same if that situation were to come up again, and how they will be interacting with these tools. AI governance enables the reduction of risk from unexpected harm and also reputational damage for an organization. So this is thinking about why an organization should do the work that's needed to have responsible AI governance. Of course, it ensures compliance with existing and evolving laws, but I put that here on the slide because this is a very quickly evolving space. And so there will be additional legislation. There will be additional regulations. I'll talk a little bit at the end about sort of my own personal views and reading the tea leaves, but this is something important to keep abreast of. And so thinking through and doing the work of AI governance enables organizations to be able to then effectively consider what some of these proposals are, and then in the policy world, potentially influence them. And then overall, I'll say it promotes a safe and ethical innovation ecosystem. And I raise this because I think what we're seeing with a lot of frameworks is a recognition that, particularly with the advent of generative AI, that there will be an ecosystem of development. And so we really want to promote that, but do it in a safe and responsible way. Okay, so it's a highly active space, and I think, Ida said, and she's totally right, that there are a lot of these frameworks, and many of them are kind of like converging on the same set of things that make a system trustworthy. Here are just on this slide a few of the organizations who are focusing on this in the healthcare space, including the National Academy of Medicine, NIST, as I said, the Coalition for Health AI, which I'll talk about a little bit later, the World Health Organization, AMA, which is not reflected here on the slide, but they came out with a set of guidelines fairly recently, and then two executive orders that both have impacts on the healthcare space, and I'll talk about both of those now. The first is from President Biden, and the second is from Governor Newsom. Okay, so President Biden's executive order on AI. This was actually signed in the fall of last year, in October, and it was entitled Safe, Secure, and Trustworthy Development and Use of Artificial Intelligence. It develops a policy framework to manage the risks of AI and directs agency action actually across, even outside of healthcare, to strike a balance between ensuring AI's potential and then also mitigating risks. There are a couple of directives here for HHS, and those are the ones I've focused on here. So the first is to establish an HHS AI task force charged with developing a strategic plan for responsible use of AI in the health sector. And this strategic plan should be accomplished within the next year. The second is to develop an AI assurance policy. And this is really focused on ensuring the quality of AI-enabled technologies, including infrastructure needs for both pre-market assessment and post-market oversight of algorithmic system performance against actual real-world data. Third, ensuring compliance with non-discrimination laws. And then also creating an AI safety program that's really focused on creating a way to capture clinical error that might result from AI that's deployed in healthcare settings. The EO also directed HHS to prepare a strategy for regulating use of AI in drug development. And then finally, to promote innovation, had some recommendations for HHS in terms of issuing grants and awards. So I'll note here about the strategic plan that it incorporates the need to include equity considerations, privacy and security considerations, but it also includes provisions that would promote the deployment of AI. And I think this is what several of the other frameworks have also done. So I'll turn here to Governor Newsom's executive order on AI, which was also signed in the fall last year. And this executive order, I think I'll note two things. One, it really focuses on generative AI. And the second is that it notes California's place as a leader on these issues. And so it's, I think, you know, in some ways a very exciting time to be in California. And as the press release for this EO stated, California has established itself as the world leader in GenAI innovation, with 35 of the world's top 50 AI companies and a quarter of all AI patents, conference papers, and companies globally. So that executive order contains directives mostly to state agencies and departments aimed at studying and deploying Gen AI ethically and responsibly through the state government. And that includes, for example, a procurement blueprint for public sector procurement of AI tools, a risk analysis report, a report on the beneficial uses of generative AI, state training for employees, and also a partnership with Berkeley and Stanford to evaluate the impacts of Gen AI on California. And there will be, I think, a conference put forth in 2024 on that. Engagement with legislative partners, and also periodic evaluation of the AI landscape. Okay, so with that, let me start to get into what are some of the building blocks of AI governance. And I think a good place to start is a document that I referenced before, which is the NIST AI Risk Management Framework. So that framework came out in version 1.0 last year. And it is, for those of you who know kind of NIST operations, it is an iterative thing. So their frameworks often have later versions as they are ongoing and iterate. It is a resource that is referenced, I think, in both of the executive orders and in many of the frameworks that have come out. And it is aimed at really incorporating the ability to include these trustworthy characteristics into the development, use, and evaluation of AI systems as they are deployed. It is not focused on the healthcare sector. It is actually industry agnostic, but it is meant as a tool and a structure for thinking about how to evaluate risk. The characteristics of trustworthy AI track the risks, essentially, that both Ida and I have spoke about. And so the idea is that a trustworthy AI system would incorporate understanding these characteristics in the context in which the tool is being used. The core is composed of four functions, and you can see this here on the graphic. Map, measure, manage, and then govern. And then within those cores, there are categories and subcategories of things that an organization can do as it works through this process. Again, the categories that are listed are actually not meant as a checklist, nor are they meant to be done in any particular steps. However, they are a way to kind of drive responsible use and a way of thinking through a set of considerations that organizations should do as they are contemplating the deployment of AI. So because the NIST AI RMF is industry agnostic, I'm going to take a deeper dive into healthcare AI governance because I think much work has been done on the frameworks for responsible AI. And I think, as I mentioned, we're seeing a lot of convergence there. But there is less on the practical steps for how to operationalize those. And that, I think, is where we're really going to start to see some work. It is ongoing, but it's really going to kind of pick up pace. So, for example, what does it mean when you talk about transparency? And what does it mean, and how do you measure bias? And do we all have accepted standards? Are we all in agreement for what that is? And the answer to that is actually no, right? And so how do we get to a place where if someone says, yes, we have evaluated this tool for fairness, everyone understands what that is and is in agreement that that is, in fact, a fair set of standards. And so that is, I think, where we're going to see a lot of work come up. There are a number of groups that are diving into this work, and I note just one of them here, and that is the Coalition for Health AI, or CHAI. So the Coalition for Health AI is a collection of members from academic health systems, from industry groups, from patient groups, from nonprofits, and also others who have come together to develop guardrails for the deployment of responsible AI in healthcare. The first work product they put out was called a blueprint for trustworthy AI. And that was really a fairly high-level document setting forth kind of overarching principles and a framework. And since over the past, I'd say, 8 months, the group has turned to developing consensus-based considerations and evaluation criteria for the trustworthy characteristics of AI analyzed across the AI lifecycle. So this is on the screen just actually a draft of the CHAI AI lifecycle, and there are other lifecycles that are out there. But the general gist I want to convey here is that it's important to think of the risks that are presented in AI across the lifecycle of the product, which includes from the very start defining what the purpose of utilizing an AI model is. Like, what is the problem we are trying to solve? And is this model the best way of solving it? What will we achieve by doing this? And then it moves into developing the model, which includes a lot of engineering of the data. And then here, I think a lot of organizations, you know, some may develop, but a lot may sort of may purchase. And so it's a recognition that you can develop, but you can also, you also might need to be purchasing that from a vendor. And then you reach the point of implementation. And in each of these stages, for each of the trustworthy characteristics, tries developing a set of considerations and then evaluation criteria that entities should ask themselves. And that will help them determine whether or not this tool makes sense for them to deploy. To take sort of one example of bias. So I think, and I think this is actually a point that I raised, bias can actually enter a model in several different stages. So for example, when you're thinking of the problem you are solving and you're thinking of a way to measure that, I think one of the concerns in the healthcare field has been that the proxy you are using, it actually itself incorporates bias, and that can be a problem. In addition, I think the data that you are using to train your model may not be inclusive of all of the data you would want for that model to be fair as it is applied. And this is, I think this came up actually in our conversation that I had with the students before, but there are places where there are data deserts, and that can impact and does impact models. And so that is another place where bias can come in. And then as well, the data can incorporate sort of human biases. And so that is another way that the bias can both enter and another way that it should be considered as these models are being developed. And then finally, in implementation, I think measuring these tools and how to measure them is going to be an important issue that gets a lot more discussion going forward. Okay, so let me take just a minute or two and talk about some of the AI governance work at UC. So this is happening both, I think, at the system-wide level and also at the level of the health locations. And I'll talk about both. And both of those efforts are actually intertwined. Because I think with all of the frameworks coming out, one of the things that people really want to do, and I think is really important, is to have efforts align. And I see this both like kind of on the national level and on the state level, but also within UC, to have, to reduce, you know, redundancy, essentially, and have there be kind of an ability to focus on some of the really important questions that need to be answered. So at the UC level, there is a system-wide AI council. And this comes out of a report that came out at the end of 2021. And this report actually was, I think, a little bit ahead of its time. But it came out of a presidential system-wide task force about the responsible deployment of AI across UC operations in several domains, of which health was one. The other domains are human resources, the student experience, and policing. And out of that report came actually higher education's first set of AI, of responsible AI principles, and very initial recommendations about how to operationalize them. Also out of that report came a system-wide council that is still working today and is focused on taking the recommendations in that report and also the evolving landscape of AI and operationalizing some of the recommendations. So as what I would think of as sort of a subgroup of the UC AI Council, there is a Health AI Governance Forum that I convene of folks from across the health locations that really look to some of the particular opportunities, but also challenges that are involved with deploying AI in healthcare. Surface difficult use cases, help cut through some of the noise, and potentially develop guidance that will be helpful, all of which is being done kind of in alignment with the UC AI Council. And so I'll turn now to a couple of takeaways for developing AI governance. And I think, you know, this is a very quickly evolving space. But I would say that it is important to address risk over the AI lifecycle. I think it is not so much that you can't get to stage two if you haven't done stage one. I think the process should be agile. But I think it is important to think about the different stages of the life cycle in determining whether or not a model is one that you might want to deploy. I think it's going to require a multidisciplinary approach, and this is something that we talked about a little bit in our discussion earlier today. But I think that here you really need more than ever to have in the room with the policymakers, bioinformaticists, data scientists, clinicians, bioethicists, and a number of other stakeholders, including, of course, legal, compliance, IT folks. It's going to require input from all of these stakeholders and the ability to kind of talk to each other and get out of silos to be able to make some of these determinations going forward. I think generative AI amplifies existing risk and also presents new risks. And so I think this is something that needs to be kind of grappled with on its own. I think there is very much, to a point that Ida raised in her talk, a black box nature of how a lot of these large language models work and the data upon which they are trained, and whether or not that means that responses that come out can be replicated. And so all of those things, I think, are issues that are we're really going to have to kind of work on moving forward. To a point I alluded to earlier, it's important to keep a pace with developing laws and regulations. And because of that, and this is a point that I made earlier, developing AI governance is going to be an ongoing process. So for those of you in the room, we are, I think, at the beginning of this, not the end. Okay, and so finally, here are some reading of the tea leaves for me about what might be happening on the legislative front and also what might be happening within organizations. And so I don't think I gave a disclaimer at the beginning that these views are only my own and don't represent the views of the University of California. But here I will sort of definitely say that. These are only my own views. But putting on a little bit my former hat as an FTC person, here are a few things that I think will happen. One, I think we are, of course, because this was in the executive order, likely to see additional agency action as they carry out the directives set forth in that executive order. I do not personally think it is likely we will see comprehensive federal AI legislation in the near future. Those things are big lifts, and it's possible that the stars will align, but I think that is challenging. That said, I think there are existing pockets of expertise across the federal government. The FTC is one example, and those agencies will take their existing authority and they will move into the spaces that authority allows. So, for example, on the FTC front, they have had a number of enforcement cases against organizations, and this is across industries, so not healthcare focused, but that are focused on AI. And so, to take one example, at the end of last year, they brought an enforcement action against Rite Aid for the use of AI-enabled facial recognition technology in surveillance. That was something of note, and I'll say that Commissioner Bedoya, who issued a statement when that case came out, made some strong statements. I don't want to misrepresent him, so I'm going to look at my notes here. But so he said a couple of things. He said, for example, the FTC is not afraid to ban the use of a particular AI technology for a number of years, or to order the deletion of biometric information collected through it. The FTC will not necessarily accept the use of biometric surveillance in commercial settings. There is a powerful policy argument that there are some decisions that should not be automated at all. And the decision extends beyond smart surveillance into the use of any technology to automate important decisions about people's lives, including decisions that could cause them substantial injury. So I think we're likely to see additional enforcement from the FTC in this area as its authority allows. On the competition front, the FTC has also been active. And just, I think, this past month, it issued orders to five large technology companies requiring them to provide information regarding recent investments and partnerships involving generative AI and major cloud services providers to understand the impact of those investments and the potential impact on the marketplace. That's a little bit on the federal stage. On the state stage, I think We're likely to see some legislative action, in my view. California is a very active state when it comes to issues of privacy. And I think last year, the California Privacy Protection Agency released draft automated decision-making technology regulations. And so those are for comment and will be potentially coming down the pike. I think for organizations, we are likely to see more organizations hire chief AI officers to think through both governance and also how to deploy at scale these technologies. And then I will finally leave you with this. So I think the cat is out of the bag. I think AI will become part of our future lives. I think it is an exciting time. And I think it is worth doing the work to have rigorous AI governance, because I think it will impact kind of all of us. So I encourage everyone here in the room and who is listening to get involved.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.